Well, in our ongoing study of the Gospel of Mark, we've been looking at Jesus' encounters with hypocritical religious people, and particularly religious leaders, during the last week of his earthly ministry. Now, there was this kind of clash for his entire ministry, but it really came to a head in that last week in Jerusalem before the crucifixion. These wicked leaders were becoming very desperate to somehow find a way to stop Jesus. He was a threat to their power. He had thoroughly rebuked them and confronted them and demonstrated their hypocrisy before the people, and they didn't appreciate that. And so in the passage that we looked at last week, in the first part of chapter 12, we saw the Sanhedrin take a direct approach to try to confront Jesus and find a way to stop him. They sent out a subcommittee. They were the ruling religious party of the nation. They were the top echelon of religious leaders, and they sent out a group to very publicly confront Jesus in the hope that that public confrontation and their positions of importance and their pomp and circumstance as they come as a group would all work to sway the crowd against Jesus, because they could easily come up with some false plot and some false accusation and have him killed. They could have had him arrested by saying something that wasn't true, but he was much too popular, and so they were afraid of the people. And so they came in a very public way, thinking that their position and their questioning of his authority would be enough to start to sway the crowd against Jesus so that they could begin to make more and more moves against him. They thought they were going to step up in a group and put him in his place, question his authority, since they were the men who were at the highest level of human authority. Jesus put these guys to silence with a very simple religious question. He asked them whether John the Baptist's ministry was from heaven or from men, and they were stuck. They couldn't answer either way without it damaging what they were trying to accomplish. They didn't care what the truth was, and Jesus just put them to silence with that very simple question, showed that they were not qualified to evaluate his ministry because they refused even to answer that easy religious question. And before he let them get away, he began telling them stories that kind of showed what they were. And Mark recorded one of those. It's the story of the landowner and the vine growers. And they recognized, these leaders recognized the right judgment against their hypocrisy in that story. They gave the answer that those men would be punished. And then after Jesus explained it a little more, they realized he was talking about them. And they were infuriated. And so they went away. They would have killed him. They wanted to kill him, but they couldn't do that. And so at every turn, Jesus has shown his superior wisdom and he's challenged their hypocrisy. And these men should have repented long before. And on this occasion, they again did not repent. Instead, they immediately tried another attack against Jesus' credibility. So in today's text, these same people sent some of their comrades to try and trap Jesus in a difficult question that they thought either answer to which was going to put at least half of the crowd against him. No matter what he said, they thought he was coming down a notch. Our text is Mark 12, verses 13 through 17, we'll read today. Mark 12, 13 through 17. It says, "Then they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to him in order to trap him in a statement. They came and said to him, 'Teacher, we know that you are truthful and defer to no one, for you are not partial to any, but teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful to pay a poll tax to Caesar or not? Shall we pay or shall we not pay?' But he, knowing their hypocrisy, said to them, 'Why are you testing me? Bring me a denarius to look at.' They brought one, and he said to them, 'Whose likeness and inscription is this?' And they said to him, 'Caesar's.' And Jesus said to them, 'Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's.' And they were amazed at him." Now this challenge is still a part of the same concerted effort that we've been looking at over the last couple of weeks, and particularly last week. The same people are behind this particular plot. But since the direct approach didn't work, bringing in the big guns and confronting Jesus publicly, they're trying another tack now. They're trying the opposite kind of approach. First, they thought that their important positions and their official status as leaders would be enough, and that they could intimidate Jesus and turn the crowd against him. And when that didn't work, they tried a sneak attack, and that's what this is. Matthew's gospel tells us that these Pharisees and Herodians who approached were disciples of the Pharisees and Herodians. So they were the young guys. They were the young guns. They were the ones who would not be recognized as easily by Jesus and his disciples. They were the best and the brightest that the Pharisees were training up in their way and that the Herodians were training up in their way. So apparently these leaders hoped that Jesus wouldn't recognize them as a threat and that he'd let his guard down and then they could get him. They could get him to say something they could use against him. Now, with any sneak attack, you've got to have a way to put your enemy off balance. And to do that, these guys try flattery. And they're pretty skilled at it. They say to him, "Teacher, we know that you are truthful and defer to no one, for you are not partial to any, but teach the way of God in truth." Now, all of that's true of Jesus. But why are these guys saying that? They've come to trap him. They're disciples, the best and the brightest, most likely, in a system that is diametrically opposed to everything that Jesus is teaching. They're working for the evil leaders who want to kill Jesus. They're in on the plot, and they're coming to try and set aside his entire ministry and trap him. And they're telling him how truthful he is, and how impartial he is, and what a courageous teacher he is, and how we know you're teaching the truth of God. We just have a hard question that we don't know the answer to, and we need some help with it. And you're the guy. You're not going to flip-flop on us. We know. Now, if they believed all of that, they wouldn't have been on this errand that they're on. And so what's happening? Why are they saying it? Well, these guys are trying to gain advantage over Jesus by doing what we call buttering him up. Flattery. Even though it's true, they're emphasizing something that they don't really believe because they think it's going to help their evil cause. The Bible gives us all sorts of warnings to watch out for this very technique by which people will manipulate us. Proverbs 29:5, it says, "A man who flatters his neighbor is spreading a net for his steps." Somebody comes up and they're telling you how wonderful you are all the time. Look out, it's a trap. That's what that means. They're spreading a net for your steps. Proverbs 26:28 says, "A lying tongue hates those it crushes, and a flattering mouth works ruin." There's a purpose when people butter you up. And according to the Scripture, it's not a good purpose. When people go way overboard telling you how wonderful you are, you had better watch out. Even if what they're saying is true, if they keep on telling you, if it's out of proportion, if they're always trying to make you think you're king of the world or queen of the world, you better be careful because they want something. Jude, verse 16 says, "These are grumblers, finding fault, following after their own lusts. They speak arrogantly, flattering people for the sake of gaining an advantage." This is what it's about. Romans 16:18, it says, "For such men are slaves, not of our Lord Christ, but of their own appetites, and by their smooth and flattering speech, they deceive the hearts of the unsuspecting." That's a lot of warnings. I didn't read all of them to you. Kind of start to get the idea that this is an important issue, don't you? All of that spread through the Scripture, warnings about people who flatter with the tongue. And yet it's amazing how this technique still works its evil magic in people's lives. All of these hundreds of years later, this is exactly how people will approach you if you've got something they want. If they think you've got the money or the power or the position to get what they want, or if they want to take you down, they're going to put you off guard by telling you how wonderful you are. And people are still quite easily fooled by this. And those who are looking to gain an advantage still gain it much of the time by smooth, flattering talk. Now, it works because of our sinful pride. It's wise to be on your guard and not to think too much of yourself and to be suspicious of anybody who does. There's something they want. But flattery only works because there's something in us that really, really likes it when people tell us we're the best that there is, that we're just great. I'm not talking about an occasional compliment. Those are nice. I'm talking about something that's out of proportion, something that's always coming at you from somebody. Flattery. And it works because we have sinful pride in our hearts that wants us to be exalted, whether it's true or not. We want to be lifted up, even in an artificial way. In fact, it will make peace with that. If it's artificial, that's okay. It still feels good. Go ahead, butter me up. I like it. Watch out, because you're going down. And that's what these guys are up to. Except the problem here is Jesus doesn't have any sin, so he doesn't have any sinful pride, and it's not going to work. Not knowing that, not understanding that, they try. And they're buttering him up. And then they ask the question that they have crafted in order to trap him and hurt him. Is it lawful to pay a poll tax to Caesar or not? Shall we pay or shall we not pay? Real cut and dried. They want a clear answer, yes or no, but it's a trap. It's like somebody saying, are you still beating your wife, yes or no? How do you get out of that one? Can't answer that with either one of those if you've never beaten your wife. That's what they're trying to do here. Is it lawful to pay this tax or not? Shall we pay or shall we not pay? They're trying to pin him down now that they've tried to butter him up. Now, the poll tax was particularly odious to the Jews. It was an annual tax per person, per head. And it was equal to one day's labor. Paid it with the denarius. Paid it once a year for every person. And it was seen by the very religious Jews as tribute paid to Caesar, because this tax went right into his treasury. And for a lot of the Jews, this was a dilemma, because Israel is supposed to be a theocracy with only one king, who is God. And even though they had forsaken that and asked for a king and gotten Saul many, many years before, still they saw themselves as, in many ways, a theocracy, and certainly not subject to Rome. And so for them, the idea of paying tribute to Caesar was thought to be at least an act against God. You know, do we pay? Can we honor God and pay tribute to a pagan king? And so this was a question that the populace really struggled with. And even those who didn't struggle with the religious connotations, because just like in our society, there were a lot of people who kind of hung out but didn't much care about the subtle issues of the faith. But even those guys hated paying the tax. Even those guys are going to get stirred up about, well, wait a minute, it's a foreign government. You know, we don't want to pay that. And so Jesus' opponents had picked something that they thought they could pin him down with and trap him, because they thought there was no good way out of this for him. If he says that it's lawful to pay the tax, then the Pharisees are going to start circulating in the crowd saying, let me tell you something. If he was the Messiah, he wouldn't be telling you to pay Caesar a tax. Okay, so let's just settle that now. They'd start working the crowd. This would give them the leverage they thought they needed. If he says it's unlawful to pay the tax, then the Herodians, who don't believe anything the Pharisees believe, but have come for the same assault, they'd go immediately to the Roman government officials and say, guys, I need to give you a heads up. You've got a rebel, and he's out there preaching against Caesar. You need to have him arrested. So what's he going to say? Either one, they're going to work it against him. That's why they've picked this issue. Well, as we've seen before, these guys don't even care for the answer. They don't want to know the answer. Their hypocrisy is clear. And this question, just like it has been in previous weeks that we've looked at this, They just want a certain result. They don't care what the answer is. They're not the least bit concerned with the truth. They just want to use something to hurt Jesus. And the interesting thing is these guys didn't even agree with each other. The Herodians were political supporters of King Herod, who wasn't actually a king. He was a Roman tetrarch. He served at the pleasure of Caesar. For them to keep their positions, Herod had to stay in good graces with Caesar. So therefore, the poll tax. You don't want to be in that job and start carrying on against some tax that's going straight to Caesar. That's political suicide. And so these guys are for the tax. But the Pharisees are caught up in the theocracy idea. They don't want Rome overseeing them in any way. They're against the tax. And these guys have come together to try to trap Jesus on the issue. Because more than they hate each other, they hate him. And now the real irony is everybody paid it. The Pharisees paid this tax. These disciples paid this tax. There's not a good way to get out of this, you know. You can't be in an important position and not pay your taxes. They're going to catch you. If you're a bum on the street, nobody knows your name, where you are, you might get away with some things, but not these guys. So they're paying the tax. So if it's unlawful, then they're lawbreakers. And they're not looking for that answer. They're not after the truth. They just want Jesus to answer one way or the other so they can hurt him with that answer. And to be sure that he doesn't outmaneuver them, or to try that, they make it a yes-no issue. Is it lawful or not? Shall we pay or shall we not pay? Now, poll tax and Caesar and all that seems long ago and far away, but this is an issue that we still struggle with, isn't it? Even without the religious connotations of living in an occupied theocracy, people still chafe under the taxes that they have to pay. And people are still looking for a way to get out of as many of them as possible. So in spite of the fact that the real purpose of this question from these people who asked it was to hurt Jesus, it would be nice to have an answer, wouldn't it? It would be nice to have biblical light shed on this issue of paying your taxes. And what do you do? And what do you not have to do? What about this? Most Americans think that it is your God-given right to cheat on your taxes. In fact, it's a sport in our country. I have a business on the side that I use to support my ministry habit, and a lot of my customers pay me in cash. And since I've had this business, I have been amazed at how often this subject has come up, and it comes up this way. People pay me, some of them in cash, right out of the cash register. And they say, I wish I could get paid in cash so I wouldn't have to pay taxes on it. You know, it would be so nice if I had some income that nobody knew about. Now, on my company invoices that I give people, it's got the company name, big letters at the top, but I've got my name on there and the phone number because if they want to pay me more, I want to know. And so I've actually had people write me a personal check to my name, even though my company name is at the top of the invoice, trying to help me so that I can hide the money. Because you can't cash a check that is written to a company, but you can cash one that's written to you. And so they'll write it to me, and I'm like, you know, I'd really appreciate if you'd make these out to the company. All the money goes into the account. And they look at me like I've lost my mind. And it's not any better when it's church people. So this is an important question. What do we do about the taxes? Shall we pay or shall we not pay? If they can't find out, is it your right just to hide that money? Do we owe a government something that when the government is becoming increasingly wicked, is it your right not to pay the sum of the money to them if they're doing all of these things that you hate? If your religion is against the law in their schools, can you not pay? Do you have to pay tribute to a government that's going to waste your money anyway? Spend it on keeping people trapped in a welfare system that encourages them not to work? Spend it on pornography that they call art? Spend it on abortions? Do you have to pay? It's It's not as bad as Rome yet, but it's pretty bad sometimes. Shall you pay or shall you not pay? Still an important question. And in spite of the hypocrisy of the men who brought the question, Jesus answers it and sheds incredible light on this age-old question. Look at verse 15 again. Shall we pay or shall we not pay? But he, knowing their hypocrisy, said to them, why are you testing me? Bring me a denarius to look at. They brought one, and he said to them, whose likeness and inscription is this? And they said to him, Caesar's. Now Jesus knows these men's hearts, and he's not fooled by the flattery, and his rebuke puts them in their place immediately. He shows their treachery just by asking the question, why are you testing me? They're guilty, and that's all it takes. Everybody knows that nobody's fooled by this. Everybody's figured out now what's going on. There's no good answer to why they would try to trap him, so they're clearly guilty. But then Jesus moves on to the answer. And these guys had to be thinking, we might get away with this yet. One little sentence, and now he's going to answer. That's okay. We can take the hit just so we get the answer. He says, bring me a denarius to look at. Now, this was the coin that the poll tax was paid with. It was a small silver coin that had Caesar's image on it, sort of a picture of him. And it was valued as a standard day's pay for a worker in the vineyard. So it wasn't just a coin. It was a coin that had a specific monetary value. Everybody knew what that was. Everybody agreed on what that was. If it was the most recently minted coin, there were two in circulation at this time. The most recent one that you could have paid this with, the superscription said, Tiberius Caesar Augustus, the son of the divine Augustus. So it's saying Augustus is God and I'm God because I'm his son. And on the back it says, chief priest. If it were just the older coin, then it only had the father's name on there as being divine. Now, the Jews didn't particularly like the picture, but they really hated the words. This coin that we're having to pay this tax with proclaims this man to be God. And we know there's only one God, and it isn't him. So this is an ugly thing for them. And these Pharisees and Herodians must have been thinking, we got him now. He's going to hold up the coin. Everybody knows what it says. He might even read it. We're going to catch him now. So they're like, quick, get him a denarius. And somebody gets one and brings it. And he asks them. Now, Jesus' wisdom is so, it's infinite. And so he's not having a problem here. They just think they're getting somewhere. But I want you to notice that these guys who ask the question are readily able to produce the coin. They didn't have to come back another day. Somebody among them had this coin or got one, you know, made change, brought it. This coin was standard currency in Palestine at that time. And their readily producing one demonstrated that Caesar had real authority in their lives. They had the coin. They were using the coin in their regular getting by in life. They personally participated in a system that Caesar was the head of. Now, whether they liked the details or not, they benefited from the provision of this standard currency. They benefited from the stability that this lent their economy. They didn't have to trade in chickens and eggs and goats and sheep. And this is only worth half a sheep. What are you going to do then? They benefited from the stability of an established government, whether they liked Caesar or not. They benefited from the protection of his army, from the legal system, from the roads, from the water systems, everything. Whatever the flaws were, there were still real benefits. And those guys coming up with that little silver coin proved that they were in the system. They were in a system in which Caesar had real authority. and real power, and in which he had every right to require them to give something back to participate in keeping the system going. This is how God set things up. People tend to want to say, well, since it's not perfect, I shouldn't have to pay. Or at least I ought to pay less because some of this is evil. I mean, some of it's pretty bad. I shouldn't have to pay. Jesus doesn't even entertain that thought. What he says is, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. And the word render literally means give back or pay back. So you're in a system. You're benefiting from the system. The world would be chaos without some system. And so you're in it. You're the beneficiary. And you have to pay something back to keep the thing going. People say, well, I don't mind paying for the army and the roads. But some of this stuff, some of the things this guy's doing are not God-given purposes of the government. Some of the stuff is evil. Why should I have to pay for that? Well, I'll tell you, the issue that Jesus is bringing up here is not an issue of your picking and choosing which things you like and which you don't like. It's an issue of authority. And the question is whether or not you submit to authority. God has set up structures so that the world will not be chaos, so that the world can function without being in a constant state of chaos. And systems of government are one of the things that He's set up. Everything in your life is based on this idea of authority and submission. Now, Americans don't like it, but we still live in that system. That's how the world works. Someone has to be in charge. The most ridiculous term in our language is co-chairman. Somebody has to finally decide. Now, sometimes you decide by a vote, and okay, that's still a system. And in that system, whoever won the vote is in charge of that issue. But there has to be a way for somebody to have authority and somebody else to submit. Someone has to have the final say. Somebody makes a decision in any area of life. And God has set this up. He said how it'll work in your family. He said how it'll work in the church. He said how it'll work in the workplace. And He's the one who established governments. And He's very clear on this issue. You're to submit to authority. When you're under it, your job is to submit to it. Look at 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning with verse 13. 1 Peter 2:13. This is pretty blunt, but I'm just going to read it, so don't be mad at me. 1 Peter 2:13. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority, or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Now this passage acknowledges the presence of foolish men, and some of them are in government, and some of them are in other positions of authority over you and other segments of your life. The Bible doesn't act like that's not real. It mentions the foolish men. But what it does not do is make any provision for something called partial submission, which is not submission at all, but that's what we like to try to do. I'll submit here, 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 and here, but I don't like that one, so I'm not submitting there. Well, you don't really find out if you're submitting until you don't like it. Otherwise, you just agree, you know, you think you're in charge. Okay, let's do that. I like that idea. That was my idea. That's not submission. You find out whether you're submitting or not when something rankles you. There's no provision in the Scripture for you to sort of submit, partially submit, hold a few things back if the government is really bad or if you disagree with something. Instead, you have, this text says in 1 Peter, you have a tremendous opportunity in the midst of all of the foolishness around you to demonstrate your testimony of knowing Christ by submitting just like He submitted to the Father. by submitting, even in an imperfect situation, you can show forth the change that Christ has brought about in your life, and people will see that difference because they don't want to submit. And they'll scratch their heads when they see you doing it. A big part of your submission to an imperfect government is your testimony. And it says in this passage that you do that for the Lord's sake. You submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it's the king or whoever it is. Look also at Romans chapter 13, beginning with verse 1. Romans 13, verse 1. Again, we're dealing with absolute statements here. There's no wiggle room at all. It says, every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. It is a minister of God for your good. That's talking about government. It is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger, who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Not very American, but it is in the Bible. It's a hard thing for us to remember as we go through the routine of our life that God allowed this government to be what it is. He allows the people who rise to power to be there. Imagine when this was written, it was much worse. Rome had declined even more than when the Gospel of Mark was written. Government has not come to power outside of God's providence. Twice this passage in Romans calls the government a minister of God. His minister. For good and for punishment of evil. Twice it's a minister. Depends on how you act, which one is it is for you, whether it's for good or whether it's for punishment. So, vote to change what you don't like. Write letters to your representative. Call him on the phone. Call her on the phone. Fuss. Get in your prayer closet on your knees for hours and beseech God to change what you don't like in this world. But you don't get to not pay because you don't like something. That is not the solution. You know who you're stealing from? The people sitting around you, if they paid theirs. How different would our country be if all of the people who are putting that cash in their pocket and not in their business account paid their taxes? Even our government would wonder what to do with all the money. And you wouldn't have to pay so much. It'd be so much easier to change a few things. But people won't submit to authority. And that's the issue. It's not whether you like it or not. It's whether you'll submit at any point. We're to submit to all human authority, knowing that God has allowed these things for His own eternal purpose. You submit to the Lord for the Lord's sake. You submit to the government for the Lord's sake. You submit inside your family for the Lord's sake. When your boss says do it and you don't like it, but you do it for the Lord's sake. Authority and submission, it's how the world works. And the world would be chaos without it. And a lot of the chaos that's in the world is because people resist it. How many of you have had an employee who just won't do what you say? No matter what you say, no matter how well you say it, it doesn't come out that way. It's because they don't want to submit. They don't want to have to listen and pay attention and do what they're told. But God set this world up so that it would not be chaos. And even in the midst of the wickedness that is in authority, you can have a shining testimony by submitting yourself to that authority for the Lord's sake. People will see that difference. The people of Israel were laboring under a false dilemma. It wasn't an either-or situation at all. They could pay the tribute to Caesar without offending God. God was the one who let Caesar rise to power. God was the one who let that wicked man come to power. And a part of that was so that everything would be ready for the arrival of His Son who would die for sin at the hands of those very people in that government. Well, you and I are in the same situation. You participate in the benefits of a less than perfect government. You benefit from the stability, from the protection, from the provision that you are afforded through having an earthly government, even though it's not perfect. Far from perfect. It's way better than the chaos that comes without one. And you have an obligation to that government before God to do what you're supposed to do. God expects you to meet your obligations to the government. And how you meet them is an important part of your testimony. Well, it's amazing the light that Jesus sheds on that age-old question with so few words. He answers the question in such a way that He's not trapped, but everybody knows what their real obligations are. And then there's a much greater lesson that He adds on the end. He tacks on something they didn't ask about. He says, "And to God, the things that are God's." Now the verb render is still in play. Render to God the things that are God's. Give back to God what He expects from you. Now here's where you're the beneficiary of a perfect government. You're the beneficiary of all of God's goodness to you. Everything you have has come from Him. You're breathing His air right now. When you go to lunch, you'll eat stuff that grew from His dirt because His sun shined on it and His water fell on it. Everything you have comes from God. Your ability to work and earn a living, your health, everything. You're participating in His government. The difference is His government is perfect. He has unlimited authority over your life. The earthly government has certain limits. God doesn't. There's no flaw in His government of your life. And His authority is without limitation. He's your maker and provider, and every person on earth ought to be giving Him perfect obedience and perfect worship. And yet, here's the thing. Here's the proof that it's not about, "I don't like that and I don't like that," but that it's about, "I won't submit to authority." People won't submit to this perfect government either. If it were about, "I don't like what the money's going for," people could submit to God because there's nothing wrong with His government. But they won't. They won't give tribute to God. They won't give worship to God. They won't give their obedience to Him. They won't submit because they want to be the authority. And these Pharisees and Herodians are good examples. They've come using their God-given logic to try and unseat God. They're breathing in God's air and breathing out hatred of God. Breathing out deceptive words to try and harm Jesus. They use the intellect that God gave them to plot against God. He has real authority, and that's where the problem is. They didn't want that. They wanted to be the authority. There may be people in this room who have this exact problem. Never submitted your heart to God because you don't want to submit. You do what you have to because you don't want to go to jail, but you haven't submitted your heart. And if that's the case, there's only one hope. And that is that you will bow before the Lord Jesus Christ and ask for His mercy. You will submit yourself to Him in this life, or you will endure forever the condemnation of those who have rejected Him. He is the only eternal hope. you have offended him. And you have to cry out for forgiveness. In prayer, you ask him to forgive you. And you trust his provision for you on the cross. You believe that Jesus bore God's wrath over your sin and paid in full that penalty on the cross, then you will be saved. Believe it and be saved. And then you live for him. Trusting him even in an imperfect world, even with an imperfect government. Your ultimate obligation is to God, and he gives you everything you need. Well, has it occurred to you that how you live your life and how you submit to authority is perhaps your greatest testimony in this world? If you do it right, it has a power that we really can't even get our minds around because it's so different from the world. And they see it. If you can't submit to your boss when he says do this or she says do this, and you don't do it, your problem's not with the boss. Not if it's not a morality issue, or if they're not telling you to deny the Lord, and you won't do it. Your problem's with God. He's the one that didn't let you be king or queen. If you can't submit within your family, your problem's not your family. Your problem's with God. He's the one who established authority and submission. Real authority comes from God, and how you submit to it is a powerful part of your testimony. Submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God that by doing right, you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. That's your mandate. So don't cheat on your taxes. Bow with me in prayer, please.